coming up next on Is It Just Speculation?
At the time that when I was sitting around with those guys at the White House team, we were having spirited discussions, I'll say, about whether or not the shootings were increasing or whether the media was covering them more. And I was kind of the idea, given that I was dealing with law enforcement, that the shootings were increasing. And some of our other people were very insistent on the team that, no, the media was just making a big deal out of the shootings. And so I kind of thought, you know, I'm the only law enforcement guy here. I guess I'm going to have to come up with an answer to that.
Hey everyone, it's Chris, the host of Is It Just Speculation, the podcast where we take a look at the gray areas of life together. Today I'm joined by Catherine Schweit, the creator and former head of the FBI Active Shooter Program. Today's episode is definitely a hard topic to talk about, and there might be some graphic details or there might be some things that are a little bit upsetting related to active shooters and the recent shootings. Just a word of caution, if you don't want to hear it, feel free to skip this episode, and if you are okay hearing it, there's a lot of good information for you. Stick around for more. Hi, Catherine. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing okay. So first of all, I wanted to say thank you because I know you're especially busy these days since the Uvalde shooting, of course. There was a medical office building and then a whole bunch of them in the last few days. Before we really start, like, is it just seem like there's a lot more shootings, or has the media kind of picked up on it more and just been reporting them more often? How do you kind of see that?
Well, there are more shootings, but I will say that the media is counting them, which is something that I hate for them to do. And they'll say there were three mass shootings this week. There were five such, and you know, so they're counting them. And when they do that counting, which they, you know, they do to some extent, but this has been an extraordinary, since the Buffalo, I think it's been an extraordinary amount of coverage that is very, very aggregate. Everybody is like the worst and how many we've had in this state, and they're categorizing a lot, and they didn't used to do that. And the bad part about that, in my opinion, is, which is what you were asking for, is that we lump in gang warfare and drug warfare and problems in domestic situations together with shootings in shopping malls and, you know, shootings in schools. So I think then it just kind of muddies the water. And basically what we're dealing with when we hear all these numbers all pushed together is not about mass shootings. It's just about firearms violence. And I think people need to recognize that that's the language that we should use. We're just talking about firearms violence now.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into who you are and what you do specifically, either in your, you know, pre-retired life and what you're doing now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was born in Michigan. That's, you probably don't want it back that far.
No, we can go all the way.
well, I was born in Michigan, as a matter of fact, not in Detroit, not far from where the Oxford High School shooting was. But I worked as a journalist in Michigan and Chicago, and then I went to law school and joined the prosecutor's office in Chicago. So I was an assistant state's attorney in Chicago, and then eventually recruited by my cousin away to the FBI. And I was an FBI agent for 20 years, which I really liked. And I left in 2017, when I hit the mandatory retirement age, and left to thinking, okay, well, now I'm going to go off and find some nice job that's not as stressful as being an FBI agent. Mm-hmm. And that never worked. And here I am 5 more years later, still working on mass shooting situations, because it doesn't go away. And the numbers are worse. So I really was a counterintelligence agent and worked on national security matters for a long time in the FBI. But after the Sandy Hook shooting, 5 years before I retired, the Sandy Hook shooting occurred, and I was assigned, you know, voluntold, as we say in the FBI, where I was voluntold, mm-hmm. hey, you're going to be on this Vice President Vice President Biden's team over at the White House looking for solutions. And so I became the FBI's active shooter. I created their program and came up with training for law enforcement and for individuals across the country. And I did it, of course, not alone. I did it in conjunction with other federal agencies and local agencies. And like Run, Hide, Fight came from the city of Houston. Their mayor's office developed it just the year before Sandy Hook. And I found it and said, this should be national. And I pushed it through nationally, despite some objections.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a good summation of kind of where you came from. And I did have a, you know, follow up to that. Being a Chicago prosecutor, where Chicago is known for having so much gun violence anyways, do you think that played a part in them selecting you for that task? Having that background where you made it may have seen more shootings and been involved in that already?
No. I think in the FBI, and agents, and you do whatever mm-hmm. you're told. And, you know, I was just, you know, in the hallway at the right time, I guess, or the wrong time.
All right.
And so, yeah. So I was up in the director's corridor and they're like, hey, come here. I got something for you. So it didn't hurt to be a lawyer. You know, it didn't hurt to have that kind of background. And before that, I had worked over in our Washington field office, just a handful of blocks away from FBI headquarters. Okay. And during that time, you know, I worked on incidents that occurred, including the Holocaust shooting, the shooting at the Holocaust Memorial. So, you know, I was certainly familiar with the concerns.
Yeah. And one of the really cool things that I thought that you did was you co-authored a study, I think in 2014, with the FBI and Department of Justice. And it was on a study of 160 active shooter incidents in the United States from 2000 to 2013. What did that study find? And what was unique about that study?
I did co-author that, mm-hmm. you know, at the time that when I was sitting around with those guys at the White House team, we were having spirited discussions, I'll say, about whether or not the shootings were increasing or whether the media was covering them more. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of the idea, given that I was dealing with law enforcement, that the shootings were increasing. And some of our other people were very insistent on the team that, no, the media was just making a big deal out of the shootings. And so I kind of thought, you know, I'm the only law enforcement guy here. I guess I'm going to have to come up with an answer to that. So I didn't really have an idea of how to do that until it kind of dawned on me. Why don't I just pull the police reports from every single potential shooting and have an analytical team look at them? We'll come up with a way to categorize them and we'll look at them over a big span of time. So to see whether or not the shootings have increased. And, you know, all the researchers that had been working had never had an opportunity to actually get law enforcement reports. And so that made this kind of a unique opportunity. But as the FBI, we could ask these law enforcement agencies, hey, can you go to your dusty old files and pull this, you know, 2001 shooting that occurred? And so we can look at the data on it and have real data. And so that was great because we were able to pull the original files from law enforcement because they were so generous in doing that. And then we pushed that information together and found out absolutely the shootings were increasing. They were increasing exponentially. Like just as an example, when we had the research we went back to, we started the year after the Columbine shooting, which I can explain why, but we started the year after the Columbine shooting. And, we found in the first 7 years of the 14-year study that there were six incidents a year on average. In the second part of the study, and like in the last 7 years, there were 16 incidents a year. So we went from six a year average to 16 average. Last 2 weeks ago, the FBI released its numbers for last year, and there were 61 incidents. Using the exact same criteria, using the exact same methodology and resources. So we went from 6 to 60 a year.
So it sounds like you kind of set the template for them to use, and that's the same thing that they're continuing to use. Is that right?
That's right. They use the same. As a matter of fact, the day that the report came out, I was having lunch with the head of the FBI's program. And he picked up his phone and he said, oh, they just released our numbers for this year. So, So I, you know, that's something that they're using the same methodology that we established back then. And we now have, you know, more than 20 years of research that tells us, you know, what we're seeing. What we're seeing certainly is an increase in shootings. But, you know, I can tell you one thing that I think was, you know, there's a lot of data we picked up out of that research. One of the things that I think is encouraging when I look at the numbers that came out over the last few years, this is one of the few encouraging things. Although the numbers of shootings have increased, the number of casualties have plateaued. So that means that even though there are more shootings that fit into this category, there are not really any more deaths and people wounded. So casualties are killed or wounded, and there's not a proportionate increase, which in the beginning there was. So we're doing a better job. We're doing a better job as citizens in protecting ourselves, and we're doing a better job in law enforcement at getting to the shooter.
Yeah, I thought it was great that you were able to put that into actual data and break it down to make it digestible, because a lot of time there's mix-ups in definitions from different departments to kind of categorize things the same way when it might be defined a little bit different. And, you know, about the study, it was the first of its kind. And why was it not done sooner?
You know, I think that we just didn't realize that we needed it done, right? I mean, there was research being done by academics, but they were using, you know, open source data. That's what we call it. And they're using police reports. They're not using police reports. They're saying, hey, we're going to look at what we can find in the newspaper. And mind you, you know, the internet, even though we all live in it every day, you know, it's not that old. And the ability to find out, you say, okay, how many mass shootings occurred in the 1930s? How are you going to find that out? So, you know, there were a lot of efforts done where, you know, researchers were looking through microfiche, but then it's a question of, did it actually appear in the paper? Was there a newspaper where that shooting occurred? In the old days, you know, a newspaper in, you know, New York City might cover a shooting that occurred elsewhere in the state, and it would report it in a paragraph. And it would say, you know, six people were killed in a shooting at the home of, you know, Billy Smith. There's no idea why, who the six people were, what the circumstances were. And so the news reporting itself, you know, was much more limited in those years before. And there wasn't any, there was no internet to document things endlessly, whether we wanted or not. So we didn't have, you know, there really law enforcement had the data, but nobody was collecting it because there wasn't any need to. Law enforcement historically has been reactive. They go out there and protect things when things get bad. And I think in the last, you know, 15 or 20 years, one of the things law enforcement knows is that the more proactive they are, the less likely that they're going to face criminal challenges. And I guess the obvious example of that would be see something, say something. And after 9/11, after 9/11 occurred, you know, look at how many thousands and thousands of tips came in and that prevented other incidents in the United States. We just aren't getting that kind of response for these kinds of shootings. If people would be as aware as they were after 9/11 and see something and say something, we wouldn't have this problem, I think.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I found fascinating with your study specifically was the way it broke down all the injuries and the incidents. Because like you said, it might report in the newspaper six people dead, but it doesn't break down how those people died. Often the shooter will kill themselves, or often there'll be injuries tried to escape the shooter. Like some people will jump out of a two-story window and then they get counted as a casualty. So the way that you broke down the specifics, I thought was really helpful to the overall picture of what people are looking at when they look at, you know, those shooting incidents and the things that come outside of that.
Yeah, I think there were really good pieces of information that hadn't come out before. It's nice of you to say that. I point that out. I'll tell you one of the things that a couple of things that struck me most when the study was first released. You know, I would have people ask me, well, you know, what did you think? What surprised you the most and things like that. And you know, one of the things that I still recall is that. And almost half of the incidents where a law enforcement officer had to engage a shooter, the law enforcement officers were killed or injured, meaning that It's a very, very volatile situation, and law enforcement needs to get better training, which is why that we pushed and put millions of dollars of your tax money into training local law enforcement, so that they would be able to go directly to a shooter safely. They would be able to do their best to go directly to a shooter and neutralize the threat. That's what their training is. That's what they should be doing right now. So there's that law enforcement danger. The other thing that I think in the research that I didn't expect is you mentioned there were 160 incidents, but in 21 of those, 21 of 160 incidents, and I don't do math, so I don't know what that is.
You and me both.
I'd have to look at my research and show and look at it. But in 21, and all you mathematicians listening, you know already, you're laughing at us and saying how stupid we are. 21 of the 160 incidents, the shooting was stopped by an unarmed individual who stopped the shooter. And that really surprised me. That really told me that we have a lot more power and control over a situation than we think we do.
Yeah, and for those listening, I know there was, in the same study, five people that stopped the shooter that were non-law enforcement that had their own weapons, whether that was security or somebody that was like a bystander that had their own weapon. So when you look at like the comparison, 21 without weapons versus the five with weapons, there's a little bit of a difference that maybe people would be shocked by. So that 21 people that, you know, stopped the shooter without any weapons at all is really, you know, mind-blowing for me too.
Yeah, and let me tell you about that. Let me see if I can tell you about those five. Mm-hmm. Just bear with me here.
Sure.
Because those five, I want to make it clear. I hear good guy with the gun all the time.
Yes.
And I would say to your listeners, you know, I spent 20 years carrying a gun for the FBI, and I have a gun. So, you know, this isn't about Second Amendment rights and guns and that.
Yeah.
I think it's more about, here's the other of the 21 in, there were 45 incidents where law enforcement had to engage the shooter, and 46.7% of the time, you can see, I pulled the stats out, the law enforcement officers were killed or wounded. There were three incidents, because you mentioned five, there were three incidents where an armed, non-sworn security person was killed. So those were security officers, people hired to be security who were not armed, who were armed, and not, but not law enforcement. And they were killed at the scene. So in three of those instances, in two instances, there were unarmed security officers. There were two additional incidents where there were unarmed security officers killed and wounded. And that is not, it's a high risk for security too. But let me tell you about the unarmed guys, or the armed guys. Of the others that you mentioned, the armed individuals who were not law enforcement, who exchanged gunfire, make this clear. There were five. Three shooters were killed. One was wounded. One committed suicide. The individuals involved had valid firearms permits, and there was an armed security guard at a church. There was an armed security guard at an airline counter that was at El Al in LAX. A federally managed museum security guard, so a trained armed security guard, mm-hmm. and a security guard at a school board meeting. So we didn't have, and I think that's important to remember when we talk about somebody else who's not a law enforcement officer, the people who returned fire successfully were, or engaged in fire unsuccessfully, were still armed security officers. So in two of the incidents, two armed off-duty police officers engaged the shooter. In one, we had an off-duty officer who assisted a responding officer. So I'd like to support good guy with a gun, but there's zero data. Even that was my research years ago. Mm-hmm. And since then, almost no data to support good guy with a gun.
This is a great time to bring in. Yeah. I think that's good to point that out, because that is one of those arguments that comes up a lot with the, you know, good guy with the gun can stop a bad guy with the gun. But I think it's a good time to bring in one of the listener questions from Marissa. And the question is, what are your thoughts on armed personnel in schools, churches, et cetera, and do they make a difference? You kind of alluded to them not making, too big of a difference, but for those people that choose to put, there's a lot of police that go to church attendings and they basically just act as security. There's some schools that are kind of doing a similar thing with either resource officers or something similar. How do you feel about those?
Well, so there's a difference, right? And I think that's the important part is not to glom them all together. When you talk about a church, I know churches that are have in religious institutions, synagogues, who've synagogues particularly who have faced terrible threats, they have chosen to have armed security, and as long as the armed security is trained, they're protecting their environment. That's no different than a security officer who's hired to stand inside of a bank. And as long as those individuals are trained and they know their job, I think they can make a difference. And they can also act as a deterrent. Sometimes a shooter won't go to some place where they see somebody visibly armed standing at the doorway. But it is, as I mentioned in the research that we showed, it is a volatile position because if somebody comes in and they're intending on killing people and they don't care if they get killed themselves, they're going to shoot people, and oftentimes the first people they shoot are the armed security. So security needs to be very aware. Now, if you ask me about arming school officials, that's a horse of a different color. I do not support arming teachers because that's not what they were hired to do. Law enforcement is hired to provide safety and security to the citizens around them. They're trained in it. Teachers are hired to nurture. And our research showed, and the research that you mentioned showed, that middle school students shoot up their own middle schools and high school students shoot up their own high schools. So my question would be to somebody who's a teacher out there, I have a kid who's a teacher, could you raise a gun and kill one of your own students? And I don't think that every teacher I've asked that question to, and it has been a lot, has said, absolutely not. I would try to talk them out of it. And I know the names of teachers who aren't alive anymore because they faced a student. I don't think that that will work. So I think arming teachers, and now maybe I might add this caveat because your listeners who are outside the United States are like, you guys are crazy. What are you even talking about?
Yes. Yeah, I've talked to a few people from Poland especially, and they have like no idea what we're doing because we're so different from them.
And I think that, so let me just say this about like the concept of teachers. The United States is a big country, and we have 50 different states, and we have 50 different state laws. And the state laws govern a lot of how and where and when guns can be handled by individuals and in schools and in churches and things like that. So the state of Montana, which has very few people, has different laws for guns than the state of Texas. So I certainly can't say, oh, everything should be this way in a state, because different states have different priorities and their citizens choose how they want their protection or lack of protection to exist in their state. So the overall thing about the United States is that, I have a podcast called Stop the Killing with Sarah Ferris. And one of the things that Sarah is a Kiwi, from New Zealand, but living in London. And I get a lot of what? From her when we're talking about things, because she just thinks sometimes we're crazy over here. And maybe we are. But one of the things that I think it's important that the listeners understand is that, we have probably around 400 million firearms in the United States. When Australia did its gun buyback, they bought back 650,000 weapons. We have 20 million assault style AR-15 weapons in the United States. That's the estimate, 20 million. There's no way to even buy those back. There's no billions of dollars in anybody's budget to buy those back. So I don't have a great solution to the great volume of guns that we have in the United States, because we have in the last 20 years gone from some amount of guns that we might have been able to do something about to some amount of guns that is more than we have people in the United States, including babies.
Yeah, and I should mention they are definitely made to last a long time. So it's not like they just expire after, you know, a few years. So as long as you're keeping up with the gun, it's, I mean, it's pretty much brand new. So for sure, it makes it a difficult problem. One thing that I found very interesting in your study was that from the majority of the cases reviewed in the study, most of them were ended within 5 minutes or less, whether that's through the shooter committing suicide or, you know, other people stopping that person. And then most of them also ended before the police ever arrived. What was so different in the Uvalde shooting?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, we did find 70% of the shootings ended in 5 minutes or less, half of those in 2 minutes or less. So there are outliers where we have a longer shooting situation. The Navy Yard shooting in Washington, D.C., in the Navy Yard building, we had a shooter kind of roaming the building for 90 minutes altogether. And although law enforcement eventually tracked him down, there are other situations where we have shooters where we can see them, but they're not shooting, and we're, you know, trying to find a way to catch up with them. The Pulse nightclub shooter ran into a room. Law enforcement did not follow him into that room, a bathroom, and he was in there for about 3 hours. So we have some outlier situations that occur like that. But in Uvalde, I think, well, with this caveat, you know, we don't know, right? We don't know what's we don't have all the details in Uvalde, Texas, the shooting that where 19 children and two adults, is that right, too? It's a blur right now. Adults were killed and two teachers. And so understanding that we don't really have all the details, what we do know for sure is that law enforcement pursued at some point, were with and near the shooter who was in a room and did not pursue into that room, pursue the shooter. But it'll take a number of interviews, I think, and the Department of Justice's cops office is going to do those interviews and find the details out and kind of deconflict information from different people involved. But, you know, what we had were somewhere around 20 officers. There were hundreds of officers who responded, but we know that there were at one point as many as 19 officers in a hallway on the other side of the wall from the classroom where the shooter was.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that was interesting to me about the details that have come out so far is that the Uvalde School District had its own police department. Is this something that you see commonly, or is this kind of rare? And is there a downside to kind of delegating a smaller area to a smaller department? In this case, I think they had 4 to 6 officers with, you know, that's including the leadership. So probably, you know, 4 or 5.
Right. They had 6 officers, one chief. Mm-hmm. And the police department for the city was is equally small. But I think it's valuable to understand that 800,000 law enforcement officers in the United States, 18,000 agencies. The majority of our law enforcement in the United States are small departments of 50 or 40 or 30 sworn officers who are working, you know, day and night, three shifts, right? Mm-hmm. So very few people on duty at any given moment, which is one of the reasons why when law enforcement hears a call, even if it's not in their jurisdiction, they may go there to see if they can help, because they know that there may only be a few other officers responding from that department. But school districts do, there are school districts who choose to have their own departments. And, you know, kind of the reasoning behind that is complex, because, you know, a city may not have the staffing to put law enforcement inside of a school. They don't have the money to put extra law enforcement in as school resource officers. You know, when we collect taxes here in the United States and in our states, there's tax money that goes to the school districts, and there are tax monies that go to the city. And so if the school district collects tax money and they can and put some of that money into officers dedicated directly to the school, then they don't have to rely on the city or the county or the state who says, hey, we don't have a person to put in your school. So it gives the school districts some more control. I think the critical aspect of that. Not, you know, I say that I used to be on a village council, and, you know, budgeting is something people never think about. But you know, that's a reality of it is, you've got to have enough in your budget to hire these people and train them. And they obviously felt in that school district that they could afford to hire these officers and train them. In fact, a couple of days after the shooting, they posted for a new officer. They were looking for a new officer for their department. Sorry about the noise here. They were looking for a new officer, and they're posting. I wrote down the there's my paper that's making it clear. I wrote down the salary because I thought, wow, 37.5 to 51.8 was the posting. $37,000 for a new officer, and do the math on that, which I can't do. You know, that's not a lot of money per hour, right? And so you're asking a person to. And, you know, high school or graduate or GED. We get you the training and then you're a law enforcement officer and you're protecting the kids in the schools for $37,000 a year. So, you know, or 40. So it's its own challenge to have law enforcement there, but it's a budget challenge and it's a money challenge. And if you have all these departments and they have, you know, the edge of their budget to put people on staff, it makes me wonder how much training they actually get.
Yeah, and there's the idea of people becoming complacent, especially when you're spending, you know, all your time at one place, the school district, and there's almost never nothing that happens except maybe some fights or something where there's like a trespasser. But for the most part, you get complacent because there's not shooter incidents, you know, all the time at the same school. So is [S2] Right. [S1] There kind of a, in your opinion, is there a way for people that are in those situations to stay, you know, away from being complacent?
I think, you know, it's very hard to, you know, I guess I could liken it to somebody who's an actor on stage, right? You have to, you know, you have to be on your game and on your mark the second you walk out onto the stage. And each time you have to psych yourself into that. And that's a lot of work and stress. And for a law enforcement officer, they have to be on their mark every moment they're on duty, because of that one fraction of a chance that something might happen. And that's stressful sometimes and maybe unrealistic. You know, when you, you go to a swimming pool, a big swimming pool, you'll see that they have lifeguard stands all over and they rotate those lifeguards and they rotate them in those chairs to keep them alert. If you went to the White House or to the Capitol, you would see that the security around those buildings rotates. They never stay in a post for very long because, you know, you leave an officer sitting in a chair or sitting in a car or standing at attention someplace, eventually they're going to lose focus. And, you know, that's kind of the challenge of what we deal with on any type of security. You know, we have a high demand for law enforcement. But, you know, we demand that because society is giving us these shooters and these killers. So the better that we can do to prevent, the less law enforcement is going to have to deal with the aftermath of mopping up the mess.
Yeah. One thing that I read recently was your article from the New York Times. You wrote about what you might have missed or done differently with your team when you created the FBI's active shooter program. You've had some time to think about that after, you know, you posted the article. What did you conclude?
You know, I think we were on the right path with making sure that law enforcement had training. I think we didn't expect that law enforcement maybe to some extent couldn't execute. You know, there are tremendous, massive police departments in the United States that that have their own huge training programs. You know, New York City, of course, L.A., Chicago. But they're all stressed and strained too financially. And the smaller departments, which are the most departments in the United States, you know, maybe they don't have the money and the time to get the training that they need. And, you know, maybe that's something that we need to consider. How can we provide, you know, how can we provide better support for them? Maybe that's encouraging the counties and the states to constantly create standards and provide training. One of the things that we try to do, you know, when I was in the FBI, I always felt like I was spending my own tax dollars and I had a lot of money in my budgets and I felt like I needed to spend it wisely. And So we would create, for instance, a training program and then hand it out for free to all the law enforcement. So we felt like that way they didn't have to create the training program. Mm-hmm. We could create the training program. So I think that there are things like that maybe we could have done maybe better. Maybe I should have pushed more about run, hide, fight. Pushed harder with the schools.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to be the head of, because you look back at every single shooting and think, you know, could I have stopped that if I did, you know, X, Y, and Z different? So I sympathize with you and how you must feel when you see these big shootings happen when you were in charge of such a big program. But I definitely think that it's really good that you being in that situation can reflect on it and say, you know, maybe there was something else I could have done, even if that's not the case, just to know that you have that mindset that you're still kind of aware that you had that impact. I appreciate that. As a legal expert and someone who's been involved with the topic for years, we talked a little bit about it earlier, but what's misunderstood about the Second Amendment? Because that does come up, you know, every single time there's a shooting that's, you know, right at the top of the list for the media to kind of tackle.
Oh, well, that's a $64,000 question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think what you hear people who are not, well, let me say this. I teach a class in the Second Amendment, as I said, at DePaul University in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching it because I really felt like people didn't understand what the Second Amendment is the most, you know, ignored 27 words, you know, except maybe the amendment that has to do with quartering soldiers. And it was so ignored for so long, and there really wasn't hardly any law on it forever. And then there were a couple of decisions on the Second Amendment that kind of made people look up and say, hey, this is what the Second Amendment says. It says I have this absolute right to guns. And the Second Amendment doesn't say that, right? So let me grab my Constitution right here and point out, you know, the Second Amendment is not just the only part of the Constitution that talks about guns. The Constitution specifically says, and I believe it's Article 1, Section 8, that Congress can control the militias in the states and call up a militia if it needs to protect the country, which is exactly what happened during the Civil War, right? And the Second Amendment, one of the problems that there was during the time that Congress was passing during the time when we were signing the Articles of Confederation, the issue about Congress is going to have this right to call up the militia. We had a militia that there were states that required every man who is going to be called up to the militia to have a weapon. Now, weapons were expensive back then, and the articles said, hey, Congress can call you up and we're going to come here. And this was kind of the fight between Hamilton and Madison. Is, you know, Hamilton wanted to have a big, strong army, and others in the United States didn't. And so they agreed that constitutionally we could let the states have their militias, which would be the only police department essentially that existed at the time. The states could have their militias because in the South they needed them to control the slaves. But then the Congress could still call the militia up if they needed them to fight a foreign adversary or to fight an insurrection, as I said, which is exactly what happened during the Civil War. And the militia then is what we think now as the National Guard. The National Guard is the kind of the spinoff of that, the growth of that. So when the Second Amendment was passed, and there were certainly plenty of authors at the time, the Second Amendment was passed. It was one of a package of 10 Bill of Rights. And there were, I think, 14 or 17 put up originally. And those by Madison, and those 10, they winnowed it down to 10. The 10, many of the authors at the time said, there's nothing in these new Bill of Rights that doesn't exist already in the Constitution. It's not in our Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution that we approved. Individual rights are specified in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution itself. So the Second Amendment really has a history that has nothing to do with, we're going to let everybody have whatever guns they want. And I think that's, for me, I always say to people who are arguing about the Second Amendment, you know, understand that it starts with a well-regulated militia. They're talking about what they refer to in the Constitution itself. Mm-hmm. What our gun issues are today may be completely separate, but don't argue that the Second Amendment gives you an absolute right to guns, because we know that's not true. And we know that's not true because the United States Supreme Court has said in every single decision it's ever made, including the Heller decision, which is the most recent decision, it has said there is not an absolute right to gun ownership, period. There just isn't, and to any firearms ownership. There are all kinds of limitations. Every Supreme Court decision has said that. Even when the Supreme Court came out in Heller and said you can have, for the first time, reversing other decisions, in the Heller decision, the court said, which I think was in 2008, I'd have to look it up. In the Heller decision, the Supreme Court said there's an individual right to a handgun to protect yourself. Those that language about handguns, even that in that decision, the court was very verbose about the continued limitations and regulations that could be imposed on firearms ownership or firearms use. And the court said, in fact, that Congress is the one who should make those decisions. And isn't that what they're doing in hearings exactly today?
Yeah, I just want to say, for anybody that has any issues with any of your takes and may consider you to be like an American or anti-Second Amendment, you said, let me reach for my Constitution. It was right beside you. So definitely I will defend you to the end of earth.
Well, I'm not, you know, the thing is, I'm like a pathetically strong American. Literally, I carry this Constitution with me. And I have since, you know, for years, for 30 years. It's one of those little paper ones that I've had it with me forever. So, you know, the Heller decision, you know, I think is what people talk about, you know, and Justice Scalia wrote the Heller decision and talked about it. And people at the time, you know, just loved that decision because it did reverse basically 100 years of precedent in terms of individual rights. The court had previously said, U.S. Supreme Court had previously said in some cases specifically that there wasn't an individual right, and the Heller court said there was. So that's the court. They said that there was, and you know, I'm a lawyer. I argued cases in front of the Illinois Supreme Court, and I worked as a prosecutor. I completely respect the court in every way, but it is often quoted by gun advocates saying that Heller is an absolute right to carry a gun. And the case specifically says the opposite. I mean, it specifically says, I think I've got it up on my wall here. Let me read it. It says, it's right here. Like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. Although we do not undertake an exhaustive historical analysis today of the full scope of the Second Amendment, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, on laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions or qualifications on the commercial sales of arms. That's right out of the decision. So if you'd said, okay, we're not going to let anybody who's under the age of 21 buy an AR-15, the Heller decision specifically says that's constitutional.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make, because I hadn't heard of that. So I'm sure a lot of other people probably haven't heard of that, since it's pretty recent as well. That's one thing that comes up. The other thing that always comes up that I definitely want to ask you about is, in your own experience, how much does mental health contribute to the shootings or the shooters that you've reviewed over your career?
So mental health is a factor, and the FBI's research on stressors that prompt somebody to commit a mass shooting absolutely say that mental health is one of the primary stressors. Mental health, and I say this, not mental health as in a diagnosis of mental disease or disorder, but mental wellness, mental, you know, health with the small h, is one of the stressors. The most common stressors so park that about mental health. And let me just say the most common stressors are mental health, financial strains, job-related problems, and of course, conflicts with friends, peers, spouses. Those are the most common incidents. Everybody who the FBI researched, they did research on that mentioned, you mentioned that study, 160 active shooters that I co-authored. Mm-hmm. The FBI took those police reports, plowed through them. The FBI behavioral experts, what people call our profilers down at Quantico, we took those reports down to Quantico and said, okay, you guys, now look through here and tell us why these shooters did what they did. And they said, 62% of the ones that we looked at had had these kinds of stressors that involved mental wellness. 49% had financial problems. Mm-hmm. 35% had job-related problems. But more important, they said every individual had 3 to 4 stressors that were visible. So it wasn't just one thing. It was a bunch of things. And then something triggered them. It might have been a job loss. It might have been a breakup of a relationship, financial strain, a bankruptcy, a news report that they saw, something that they just felt like it was, you know, somebody who cut them off in the grocery store lane, and that just triggered them to react. But they were already on a precipice. So when you ask about mental health, I would add these other factors about mental health. I hate to use this phrase, people always say, but you know, that's what happens. A lot of people say, well, all these people are crazy, a term that I don't use. I'm just saying other people say that.
Yeah.
But what we know from National Council on Behavioral Health after one of the shootings down in Texas in El Paso, you know, came out with this study they'd been working on for a long time. And they said, you know, there are millions of people who are under mental health care in the United States, and to categorize all of them as the reason why there is a shooter is wrong, because 4% of violent crime in America is caused by people who have mental illnesses. And that is the same, you know, it's proportionate. That means 96% of the people who commit violent crime are not. And a diagnosis of mental illness is not a predictive factor. So if our focus is how can we prevent shootings, because somebody has a mental illness or is getting care for mental health, we're talking about people who, you know, might have suffer from depression, they're taking medications, they might be bipolar, they might have anxiety. These are people who are getting care. So when we look after the fact and say, oh, he was on depression medication, he was on it. The people who aren't on it are the ones who are doing the shootings. So
yeah.
Mental, you see the difference? Like, see, the mental health issue is, I think we say, oh, this guy's diagnosed with depression. Well, yeah, maybe he's getting care. Maybe that's preventing him from doing something. So it's not a predictive factor. But when we say, oh, it's just all a mental health issue, you're ignoring everything else, and you're pointing your vision in the wrong direction.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance to it for sure, and it makes it hard to pin down the fix for it. So it's a big problem, and it's hard to, you know, pinpoint what the actual fix is. One thing I wanted to ask you about is, in your book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis, that must have been a difficult topic for a lot of people to read, especially anybody who has, you know, personal experience with those shooting incidents. How do you balance the severity of the topic with the sensitivity that it often requires?
Ask me that again.
How do you balance the importance of the topic at the same time being sensitive to it? Because it's, I mean, we talked about studies and statistics, but there's that other side of it where it's personal and it impacts people's lives for, you know, especially for young children that pass away, and it kind of carries on. How do you balance showing how important it is, but also being sensitive about it?
I think, you know, for me, I don't do as much training now as I used to, but when I talk about training, It is a having a kind heart and a sensitive voice. You don't talk about the people who were killed and re-victimize them. I think that's one thing. And maybe that's not exactly what you're asking me. I mean, I think you have to talk about things. I think here's my burden. Maybe I'll say it this way. Here's my burden. I have to talk about it. I have to have conversations about this subject, killing kids, mutilating adults who are just in a church. I have to have those conversations. I try not to be too graphic. Mm-hmm. Trainers have to have those conversations. They don't need to be graphic. You don't need to show people with blood splatters all over the place. And you don't have to teach in a violent way, but you have to teach and guide people to understand that they can make a difference. They can prevent a shooting because we can't make the last one go away, but we can prevent the next one from happening. And that's the way you talk about it is stuff has happened and it's bad, but we can prevent it from happening again if we're better trained, if we're more sensitive to those around us.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to be called on. And, you know, in a conversation that we had previously, you said, I look forward to the day that I am not the expert in the room on active shootings because they have been stopped altogether. How has this all impacted you personally over the years? Because it's taxing for a lot of people to see it, you know, one time on the news every few years, but this is something that you've dealt with, you know, ongoingly.
Yeah, you know, boy, I hate you ask me that. Because these last few weeks have been particularly stressful, very hard. The Buffalo shootings, and you know, it started with shooting up Oxford High School near my old. You know, I was born in Detroit, and Oxford High School in Oakland County is north of Detroit. And my niece calls me, and she's all upset. She's got her kids in schools in that area, not in the Oxford High School system, but she called. She's got her kids in a school nearby and a little Catholic school, and she's upset. And, you know, when I started this, I had a kid in school. Now I have a kid who's a teacher in school. And so it's all become very personal, and I feel like I can't walk away from it. You know, and it's like everything I'm doing, you know what it's like with a podcast, Chris, you're not making any money on it. You know, you know what I mean? I'm paying people to help me do stuff. Even though I don't have any income on any of this, I just feel like it's such a mission. I just need to do it. And so that's what I do. I just feel like I can't, you know, I'll tell you this, yesterday I was so frustrated, and I'm trying to juggle all of these requests that have come in and trying to see if I can continue to educate the public and get my voice heard in different locations and try to be supportive. And I thought, you know, absolutely nothing I'm doing is something I have to do. I'm retired, you know, I don't have to do any of this. And so I'm thinking, why am I doing this? And I just feel like I can't be the one who walks away. And it kind of reminds me of, I was a terrorism supervisor during 9/11, and I heard from a lot of people who I worked with in the FBI who said, you know, I can't go home until my inbox is empty, because what if the one tip is there that's going to save us from another event?
So. Yeah, that's I think 9/11 for you, Julia Cowley, and Jerry are all kind of the big things that really show the importance of what you do. Because all of you are in different areas in the FBI and y'all had your own specialties, but 9/11 seems to be the thing that for me connects all of you to that one thing that kind of brought the importance of your work. And I think that all three of you have continued that work after retiring, which I think is great, because it's, you spend your whole time, you know, focusing on one or two things, and then all of a sudden you get done with it, but you still find that passion and that calling to do something about it. So I really appreciate that you still continue to talk to people about it, even though it's a hard subject.
Well, thank you very much. I keep thinking I'm going to be able to back away. Mm-hmm. And I was working on another book, and I just can't seem to get to it because I can't seem to get to it. You know, I'm still doing this and I'm still getting calls. And, you know, when a school calls me or university calls me and says, hey, you know, we're concerned about this and can you help us with that? How can I say no?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely don't envy your position because it is a lot of responsibility. And like you said, you don't have to do it, but the fact that you do it goes to show what kind of person you are. Which
Oh.
I, really appreciate
Well, that's
that.
nice of you to say. I'm not a very uplifting interview, am I? Hi, let me tell you about death and destruction and blood, and it's horrible.
Hey,
It's hard.
it's what
Very
you
true.
do to try to fix those things that I think people will focus on and not so much the death part. So I think people will see what I see in you. To that point, we have some more listener questions that we can get to. Maybe a little change of topic slightly. So one of the things that my wife actually asked me to ask, which I should have put first because now I'm in trouble, but here we are. So her question is, what do you think about the people that go into active shooter situations to help their loved ones? We heard about a story from one of the moms who basically jumped the fence, went in the school and got her kids and went back and got another kid from a different class. What are your thoughts on family or just bystanders going into the situations if maybe they don't think that there's enough being done?
Well, that was kind of a crazy, unique situation. But I think one of the things that everybody should understand is that shooting situations are chaotic, and they are, as I mentioned, they're over so quickly. You mentioned they're over so quickly. They're nothing but chaos, nothing but chaos. So you can't say, okay, well, when this happens, the teacher is going to tell everybody to go down the hallway, to go into this library, and then go out the back door. That's never going to happen. You can train that way, but that's never going to happen. People run like crazy, and if a civilian wants to run inside a building and do it, which I think we saw in some instances, they're going to do it, and I don't think you can stop them. I mean, that's your kid. You're going to go in there and get them. Hopefully, we know how fast the shooting can end. Hopefully, the law enforcement agencies are going to be in a position where they will be in control of the scene very quickly, and they will do what they can to control the scene and get those kids or get the adults out and get them to their families. That's the biggest concern, of course, right? Is that we take care of the survivors and the victims.
Yeah, it would definitely be hard to not go in if you're there and you see that nobody else is going in. So I sympathize with them for sure.
I don't know that we've seen that before, though, Chris. To be honest, I don't think that. I think it's kind of reminds me of that the plane over Pennsylvania, though, on 9/11. You would have before then. You wouldn't have said, "Hey, let's make a plan to rush the cockpit and, take out the guys who took over the plane." And even I say that even back in the, because I'm old, even back in the 70s, people were hijacking planes, and nobody ever said, "Hey, let's rush the cockpit," and which didn't, which is which weren't secured in the 70s. That some guy would get on and he'd say, "Take me to Cuba," and he'd stand there up in the cockpit, and nobody rushed the cockpit to get that guy out. The protocol was that they would safely take that plane. I remember answering this question after 9/11. I said, "Look, the protocol flight attendants, and the teams and the pilots was, if you have somebody who hijacks your plane, land where he says he wants to land, so you can safely get those people to the ground." And that's what it was. And that's exactly probably what the thinking was on 9/11 was, okay, well, this guy's going to take over the plane, but then he'll just land it someplace. And unfortunately, he landed it in a building. Then the protocols changed, right? And so I think that's the situation here. We hadn't seen situations where civilians said, "Hey, I can run in the building and get my people out." But we have seen, that in places. You think about, malls or bigger buildings. People escape on their own, or they go back and get somebody out if they want to, or help, or they can. They do. I've never seen it happen in a school before.
Yeah, and like we'd mentioned before, a lot of them end before police ever get there or within 5 minutes. So there's not a lot of chances, statistically for people to go in and do something like that. So I think this is for sure one of those outliers that you're talking about. We talked about the people in the plane kind of taking over and, doing something about it, even though it was kind of spontaneous. For those people that saw something like that and decided that they want to be prepared for any situation, and they are, I guess you can call them preppers, to some degree they're preppers. What kind of firearm, and this is a listener question from Robbie, what kind of firearm and or combat training do you recommend for civilians that do choose to prepare for possible attacks? Is there any go-to type of training?
You're talking about people who want to carry because they think they can be part of the solution?
Yeah, really anybody that thinks that something might happen and they're going to be the ones to respond, whether that's with the licensed gun or whether that's them going and, you know, doing like a chokehold or something. We see a lot of examples of that on, you know, people trying to rob convenience stores, for example, where somebody jumps in and ends up, you know, holding the gunman until police come. So there's some examples of it, but those type of situations where they just want to be the ones that they can respond.
Sure. So when it comes to non-armed individuals, I think I think it's important for everybody to recognize the power in numbers. That's exactly what we saw on the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania on 9/11, a plane that would have been moments later in Washington, D.C. So definitely power in numbers. Many times I've seen an individual step in and grab a shotgun on the side and stop a shooter who'd already killed a person. And that young man, who was a college student, stepped in, who my favorite part is he had no shoes on, stepped in and grabbed the shotgun and wouldn't let go of it, shook it until the guy fell over and then fell on top of him and other people joined in. So when it comes to being not unarmed, recognize that the shooters are focused. They're focused. They come in with a plan. And if you mess their plan up, if you approach them from the side, if more than one person approaches them, you don't walk into the gun, which I've seen people do and die. You know, you try to come in from a side or a direction or, you know, a below or above or whatever. But if you do it by as many people who are there, there have been many successful situations where one or more people quickly group together and disrupt a shooter. And I love that. And I've seen it happen before, and it will happen again, if long as people don't immediately shrink down on the floor and become sitting ducks. So when it comes to shooters, can I answer that part?
Yes,
when it comes to somebody who wants to carry a gun, I'm going to tell you that you, unless you have carried a gun under stressful situations, you have no idea what it's like to face a shooter. You have no idea what it's like to carry a gun and think that somebody might shoot you at any moment. So you have to be very proficient in shooting, and ammunition is very expensive. And chances are you've only shot at a piece of paper in a building, and you haven't shot while you're moving, and you haven't shot when other innocent civilians are around. Understand that when you shoot a weapon, that round goes through where it goes until something stops it. And if that means that you shoot an individual and goes through that individual to another individual behind it, you're responsible for that. And so when you raise a weapon, you have to be responsible and understand that you do not have the legal authority that a law enforcement officer has. And if you choose to be the good guy with the gun, you have to also choose to accept the legal fallout of firing a weapon at somebody and possibly being charged with murder or attempted murder. And I'm not saying that to tell you I'm telling you as a prosecutor, that is part of what you face. And you have to recognize that as you choose to save people, and that's admirable, anybody who chooses to save somebody is admirable, understand that you don't have the legal authority to do that. And so you may face criminal charges yourself. Also understand that good guys with a gun get shot and killed. I can identify some instances where that's occurred, and you're choosing to do that, but taking your life away from your family then. So it's a high risk, and people who fire under, who are not used to firing under stress, their rounds go everywhere, everywhere. And I mean, everywhere. They go high, they go low, they go wide. So if you pull a gun out and you fire six rounds at some guy who's running through a building and three of those rounds hit civilians, you have to take that burden in your own head and that responsibility for it. So don't raise a gun unless you're willing to take those responsibilities.
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't think a lot of people think about the fallout afterwards. If you survive it, if the gunman dies, what else happened afterwards? Is there shrapnel? Is there, you know, ricochet, like injuries? Like what happens after the fact? So I think that's a great point to bring up.
One more thing. You know, sure. The other thing is, you know, I was an FBI agent for 20 years. We don't have a uniform. So I carried a gun without a uniform. And one of the things that they told us was, recognize that when you go into a scene and you raise a gun to a law enforcement officer, you're a person with a gun. So somebody who lifts a gun up, who wants to be the good guy with the gun, has to recognize that law enforcement is not going to believe them, or maybe even ask when they say, I'm a good guy. I'm a good guy. So law enforcement is going to see a guy with a gun. People are being shot. They're likely to get shot too. It's all just part of what they have to recognize. So, okay. I had to just say that.
No, that's a great point. So I want to be respectful of your time so we can go ahead and wrap up. But I did want to mention something you talked about earlier, your podcast that you co-host with Sarah Ferris. It's called Stop the Killing. And I really want to say there's a great balance between the two of you. Whenever I started my podcast, I didn't know if I wanted to have a co-host or not. And I thought about, you know, how would it balance? What would our schedules be like? How do we actually work together? Because there's times where I don't want to share the you know, spotlight with everybody else. So I was like, maybe I can't be with the co-host, but you and Sarah have such a great balance that I loved it. So I highly recommend that. And the new season actually started today, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. That it does. Yeah. And Sarah's hilarious because she's so British, you know, in her Kiwi way. And she just says, what is it with the guns? You know, and then I just have to explain, here's what it is with the guns, or why do you guys do this or that? Or, and for the listeners, you know, what we try to do is we try to cover an incident every episode, just say, so we started in our first season with Sandy Hook. And if you start there, I think you'll get the journey, or you can start this season. And we start with the Texas Tower shooting, which is the first really active shooter situation that we had here in the United States, that we call it that. But we talk about the incident, what we know about the incident. And then I kind of quiz Sarah on, here's what we know about the shooter. Could you have given warning and maybe prevented the shooting? And so it really make her work for her non-money on her podcast.
Yeah, I think it's really great because she, like when I'm watching or when I'm listening to episodes, I hear things and I'm like, oh, I want to ask her about this. And then Sarah jumps in and asks you the exact question. So I'm like, yes. So she definitely asks you some really good questions and it helps with the flow of things. And I think it's just a great balance. I always love podcasts that I can like really jump into right away. And it seemed like you guys just like already knew what you were going to do together. Like it just seems so natural. I feel like normally there's like a learning curve for the first few episodes, but definitely seems like it just was meant to be. So definitely appreciate
said,
y'all.
You know, thank you. That's kind of you to say. You know, Sarah said it best. I think, the book is about, my book is, you know, is about how, you know, how can we all individually stop the mass shooting crisis and what role can we play? And she said, she read the book and she said, I'm your target audience for the book. So why don't I ask you, you know, what the audience would ask? And I think that that's why it kind of naturally fell into it. She's curious to learn, you know, what she can do and what somebody else can do and why this happens and what a shooter does and what do we know about them ahead of time? And so she asks these questions and I just try to, you know, make up the answers.
Yeah, I love it. For sure. Highly recommend that. It's called Stop the Killing. Your book again is called Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis, which I'll put links in the show description for anybody that wants to go, Chris, and check out either. Yeah, not a problem. I could talk to you all day about this and like, there's so much to cover, so much nuance. So I want to say thank you again for taking the time. Cause I mean, you're super busy and our connection couldn't have been more timely, even though it's a, you know, it's a hard subject to talk about. It's a bad thing that happened, but the fact that you were there when this all kind of went down, I thought was really good timing. And that's one thing I try to do, whatever's happening or whatever I feel like needs to be talked about is something that I'll jump in and get a guest for. So I'm not sure if you've seen any other episodes that I put out, but
great.
Yeah, there ends up being like a back-to-back type thing. Well, thank you.
I know. Timely. Your podcast is just so timely. It just, it's like, oh yeah, I was just thinking about that. I was just wanting to, I was just reading about that. Yeah. I love your podcast.
Well, thank you. So before we wrap up, is there any final thoughts you have or anything you want to share?
You know, I just want people to, be empowered. I want everybody who is frustrated and aggravated about shootings to recognize that they can stop the killings. They can by learning the signs about somebody who is on the precipice and might be doing this because they're out buying the equipment. And I want people to know how to protect themselves, you know the simple method of run, hide, fight. Get out of the area. Don't shrink down underneath a table at the mall, you know, kiosk and hope that the shooter won't see you. He's going to see you. And, you know, bullets roll across the floor. They skip on the floor and they roll until they hit somebody. So don't be on the floor. Run. It takes 2 minutes to keep yourself safe. Go out the door and keep yourself safe. And you know what? Teach your family that too.
Yeah. And just a quick, you know, breakdown of that. If you can run, you run. If you can't run, if maybe they're in the hallway or, you know, in the way, you try to hide. If you can't hide, then that's when you try to fight. So I think that's probably the best general guidance we have. So I wanted to, you know, kind of break that down a little bit. If you ever want to be back.
I know lots of people who've survived by doing all three of those things. Thousands of people.
Hey, if anybody would know, you're definitely the expert. So I definitely can get behind that. If you ever want to be back on and talk about anything, whether it's, you know, shooter related or not, feel free. I love talking about pretty much anything, as you can probably tell. I always point to my medieval combat duelist episode as like the one that, like, I'll talk about anything. So there is no limit.
I know that was a little. I was a little far afield for me, but it was educational. That was good.
Yeah. Shoshana definitely has like a lot of background that I found interesting, like being in the Army and being, you know, a veterinarian type person and also a professor of sorts. So there's a lot to people besides the one thing that they do. And I hope that I kind of shine that through with talks like we're having right now. So thank you again.
Thanks a lot. You take care, Chris.
You as well. Bye. Thanks for sticking around for the episode, and if you enjoyed this one, feel free to check out the other topics that I've covered with other guests. And if you want to support this podcast, there's a link in the description. Scroll all the way down, a little bit further, right there. Scroll a little bit up right there. It says support this podcast. If you do that, if you click that link, it actually lets you support this podcast. I know, funny, right? Coincidence. If you click that, it'll walk you through the steps, and whatever you can give, whether it's 1 cent, $1, $5, $1 million, $10, you know, whatever. It's 100% more than I had before, and it all goes towards a podcast. So please, if you want to help, feel free. If you can't, well, that's okay too. We'll be friends. No problem. See you next time, guys.